Mrs. McGuire, also Ms. Kister, yes.
Thank you again. I have raised, on behalf of Mr. McGuire, two separate issues. I'd like to take the second one first, if I may, and as time permits, I'll address the first issue raised in the brief. As the Court is aware, the government sought to admit the testimony of other sexual contact between various other witnesses and Mr. McGuire in the trial. Some of this evidence came in through Rule 413. Some of it came in through Rule 414 with respect to the younger individuals and their history of sexual contact or conduct with Mr. McGuire. Some of it also came in the form of a 404B evidence, and that was not sexual conduct per se, but evidence going to modus operandi on the part of Mr. McGuire, the use of pornographic magazines, the way massages were conducted, but not explicitly sexual activity. In any event, all of this evidence was subject to a balancing test by the Court. And in my reading of the record, I don't see that that is undertaken, if at all.
Well, what's on his side of the balance?
What would be damaging or prejudicial? Well, the nature of the evidence, for the most part, was sexual. It was a
Well, no kidding. I mean, that's what the case is about. What do you expect it to be about?
It's sensitive material. It's emotional material.
That's the nature of the case.
That's correct, Your Honor. And it wasn't a drug case. It wasn't a fraud case. It was this particular type of case.
You don't want to say that, you know, 404B or, and of course, 413, 415 is just about sex, right?
But this went beyond that. This wasn't just a recounting of the events themselves by these four witnesses. It was emotional. It was sympathetic. One of the witnesses.
And it's an emotional situation. What do you mean? They're supposed to recount it in some computer synthesized voice or something?
Perhaps tailored or limited in such a way.
I don't know what you mean, tailored. What's that mean?
One of the witnesses recalled being mortified, shocked, horrified, running from the room. There was evidence that one of these young men was pinched. There was evidence of humiliation, of shame, of fear. That goes beyond mere evidence of the acts themselves.
Well, if it were all voluntary, I mean, I suppose that would rather change the character of the conduct. Right?
Given the propensity of that type of evidence to elicit sympathy on the part of a jury, the Court, I would suggest, should at the very least have undertaken to explain why it was coming in the face of all of that and the potential.
There was a limiting instruction given, though, as to all that testimony.
There was a limiting instruction given, but we still don't know from the record what the Court's thinking was under Rule 403 in allowing this evidence in light of the nature of the intrinsic nature of the evidence.
Would you agree, Ms. Kister, that the government has defended the use of that evidence based upon the attacks on Dominick's credibility during cross-examination? In essence, without the evidence from the other boys, the case amounts to Dominick uncorroborated, his credibility and nothing else, subject to various attacks for greed, selfishness, etc. Why doesn't that provide, in essence, a transparently obvious explanation for why the district judge decided to allow the corroboration from other victims who'd been treated in similar ways?
Because it wasn't introduced on rebuttal, Your Honor. It was introduced in the government's case in chief.
Well, that was, but after Dominick testified, right?
No, it was in the government's case in chief that that
but
these...
But sequentially, it was after, for the most part, it was after Dominic's testimony. I think there were,
oh, after
Peter,
Dominic.
There
yeah.
was a Peter who testified.
Because
there was a factual overlap.
I was thinking the, okay. the defendant, Your Honor. Yes.
No. Did the defendant testify?
No.
Okay.
No.
So it's just, without these other witnesses, it's just uncorroborated Dominic subject to cross-examination. The district judge said before trial that she wasn't sure whether she was going to allow these
yes,
witnesses.
Yes, it was
right?
a tentative ruling.
Okay.
And I'm not quibbling with its admissibility under mm-hmm. the various rules. It clearly is propensity evidence. It's allowed under 413. It's allowed under 414. And I think most of this would have been allowed, if not all of it, under 404B. Mm-hmm. Because it's, you know, the MO is strikingly similar between and among all these different individuals. My problem is that that's only half of the battle here. Once a determination is made that it may be relevant and admissible, it still needs to be weighed and curtailed and tailored and limited in such a way, given the nature of the case and the high emotionality of the case.
Well, you want it presented in such a way that the jury would infer that this was consensual.
No, Your Honor. I'm thinking more in terms of the Julian case, and clearly there's not a lot of case law to go through, in this area. But if the court recalls in the Julian case, the defendant there had a prior sexual assault conviction, and that came in that case under, I think, 414. And what was introduced was the certified judgment of that prior. And a police officer testified, but the victim in that case of the assault itself didn't testify before the jury. So it was sanitized. Now, clearly in this case, that didn't exist. There weren't prior convictions and certified judgments to introduce on the part of the government. And
so what would you have liked the testimony of these people to have said?
I think it needed to be better limited in the nature of the inquiry, devoid of...
Can't you be more concrete?
I think you can limit a witness's responses with respect to how they felt about it and what emotions they were feeling as a result of it,
and
not go down that road.
Then the implication is left that it's consensual.
Pardon me?
Then the implication is left that it's consensual.
I don't think so. I think that can be elicited without the descriptive adjectives, and perhaps also the number of witnesses could have been limited.
But the government said they could have brought 20 people in with Father McGuire. There's a pretty long history here.
And I can't argue that point other than to say that from the standpoint of the defendant and his receiving a fair trial and an untarnished jury, it doesn't matter how much stuff they didn't bring in. The question is, what did they show to the jury that should have been better limited by the court?
So it would have been all right if they had all 20 testify, provided there was no emotionality?
No.
Why would that be wrong?
Because I think it's also a question of the number.
Why?
Because at some point that the number of witnesses in and of themselves becomes, I would suggest, undue prejudice.
Why?
Because then I think the risk that's run is that the conviction is going to be because this is a really bad guy.
What?
And for not on the evidence in this case, but on his past record and his past proclivities. And that's a danger. Anytime any of this other evidence is admitted in
has
a trial.
Has he been defrocked?
Yes.
And he's very old now, isn't he, 88?
Yes, Your Honor.
When did he start all this stuff?
The government, I think, can better address that, Your Honor, but my understanding from the probation report and various other pleadings is that it was long continuing.
Let me ask you about the interstate commerce issue. You say, well, he takes these trips anyway, so this is just incidental. Now, was he What kind of discretion did he have in deciding how many trips to take? Did he have a quota?
I don't know. I have a lot of questions myself about the nature of this organization, who set up these retreats, how often they were held.
I see. The record isn't illuminating on that.
It is.
Okay. One other question. What I don't understand is about these trips. So I'll give you a hypothetical question. So suppose you have a man. He has two assistants, both women. One is old and married and so on. One is young and beautiful. Okay? So he needs to have a secretary when he travels. But he decides he can take the young and beautiful one because he'd like to have sex with her, right? So, but he'd take the trip anyway with somebody, right? With one of them. But this is the one he's chosen. Now, is that a violation?
I don't know. Very good question. I appreciate the hypothetical. I don't know the answer to that. That's a close call. And my first point is a close call when you're getting into what's incidental and what's ancillary and what he would have done anyway.
In that hypothetical, isn't the focus on the assistant's travel just as it would be on Dominic's travel here?
Yes.
Under the statute?
I believe the focus is on the intent of the defendant and why it's traveling in interstate commerce or crossing state lines with the intent of engaging in sexual activity or sexual misconduct. So it really goes to the defendant and why he's crossing a state line. And in this case, I think it's clear that...
But you see, in my example, another way to think of it is, why is he taking this person across state lines? Not why is he crossing, why is he taking her? Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Kistner. We'll give you a minute after we hear from Ms. Porter.
Good morning, Your Honors. Julie Porter for the United States. To pick up on the other victim's issue, Your Honor, the district court judge did properly exercise her discretion to admit other victims' testimony under Rules 413, 414, and 404B. In offering this evidence, the government had before trial laid out in detail both what the proposed evidence would be and the various theories of admissibility for that testimony. In our initial pretrial filings, we had proposed introducing the testimony of five victims aside from Dominic. We ultimately only called four of those. But as we explained both in our written filings and in a lengthy pretrial conference with the district court judge, this evidence was extremely probative in this case. The government could have called many witnesses, many more than
four. Ms. Kistner is just complaining about their testimony about psychological effect on them, that sort of thing.
There was very little of that, Your Honors. The main import of these other witnesses' testimony had to do with the particular interactions they had with the defendant, the particular plan and pattern that he had used with them, the grooming techniques, the ways that he was able to travel with them in the first place, and the manner in which he transformed that experience from one of simply assisting a priest on his travels for these retreats into one of illicit sexual conduct. There was very limited testimony in certain cases, many times on cross-examination by defense counsel, about the impact that this had on them. To give the court one example, the witness David was cross-examined about the fact that he had never told people about what had happened to him at the time that it was occurring. Defense counsel asked a question along the lines of, after this happened, you went down and laid your head on the pillow and went to sleep. Isn't that right? You never told anybody about this. And the response from that witness was, you know, don't make me tell you how many sleepless nights I've had. It was in that nature, and that was emotional. It did have an impact on those in the courtroom, but that certainly was not the thrust of the directs here. The government was not questioning witnesses at length about their feelings or how they had reacted to what the defendant had done to them. In the pretrial discussions, Your Honor, the defense did raise a 403 objection. They did say it would be unfairly prejudicial, and the district court judge did address that. She addressed that most notably in identifying the very limited number of the witnesses, the limited nature of the testimony, and also the extent to which these particular witnesses were close in time. The defendant had, at least in the government's view, had a history of molesting boys for many, many years, for decades, in fact. The government had presented to the court that it could have called 20 witnesses on this topic. However, the government was limiting its evidence to those witnesses who had experiences with defendant within a period of 10 years of the defendant's travel with Dominic. Those were closest in time, and both because of that and because of the particular nature of the interactions, they were the most probative. They were the most relevant for the jury to hear. The judge also made her ruling conditional. She was aware of the fact that the unfair prejudice calculation might change depending on how defendant defended the case at trial. Here, as Your Honor noted, Peter was the first witness and Dominic was the second. In terms of the victims, Dominic was the second victim to testify. And it was very clear from the cross-examination of Dominic that it was a very vigorous cross-examination. It was a very vigorous attack on his credibility. The theory of the defense was quite clear that Dominic was making all this up, that this was all about money, that none of these things ever happened, that defendant was a holy priest who would never do any of these things to a child, that he was physically infirm, that the purpose of this travel and the purpose of bringing children on the travel was simply to help him with his various ailments. And so that attack was very clear in the testimony of Dominic, and the other witnesses then testified from there. And in the defense case as well, of course, the government's witnesses had been presented at that point, but the defense called more witnesses than the government to establish those points.
During trial, Ms. Porter, did Judge Pallmeyer go back and explicitly readdress that question of 403 balancing after the cross-examination of Dominic?
She did not. There was a reference during some of the jury instruction conferences about the fact that the judge's decision to admit the testimony was still provisional. For example, the parties convened with Judge Pallmeyer during a break in the trial after the government had already started calling these witnesses, and defense counsel asked the judge to table the discussion of the government's proposed instruction that laid out the particular witnesses and the particular reasons for which they would be offered until everything was done, because the judge's ruling had been provisional. But there was not a detailed exposition on the court's 403 balancing at that time.
I understand your position to be that she doesn't have to explain the obvious, but can I ask you about one other question here?
Of course.
I think a few minutes ago when I was talking with Ms. Kister at the end of her presentation, I may have been confusing 2423A involving transportation of the minor with 2423B, which is the travel of the defendant.
Right.
I'm curious as to why, under these circumstances, you elected to proceed on a B theory rather than an A theory.
Yes, given you're taking me back, Judge.
Well, it may be not critical here, but I'm curious. So.
The short answer is I don't remember. I was the prosecutor who saw charges on the case. Mm-hmm. And Your Honor is correct, if I'm remembering correctly, that 2423A involves the actual transport of the minor for purposes mm-hmm. of engaging
yes.
in illicit sexual conduct, but I'm afraid...
It's sort of the classic Mann Act that lives in our memories. But
I do, and mm-hmm. of course, this case involves charges that arose from way back, and I know there have been multiple amendments to that statute over time. I can't say with confidence that that's the reason why we elected the charge we did here.
Okay. Thank you.
Backing up a little bit, too,
yes.
When you finished Dominic's examination and began calling the additional three, I guess, other victims. Did the defense renew its objection to that testimony?
The defense, the next witness that was called was Michael. And during a sidebar, the defense noted for the judge, you know, again, this is his objection, and he asked for continuing objection to the testimony so that he wouldn't have to keep interrupting.
But the subject of the concern about the 403 balance was referred to in that sidebar?
No, it was not specifically referred to, but the defense counsel had made clear that he objected to any other victims being called at all for any reason.
Everybody knew what he was talking about.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And as we point out, the judge did give a very appropriate limiting instruction to the jury that carefully tracked the language of the rules of evidence. It was witness specific, so it was very clear for the jury exactly how that testimony was to be used.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Porter.
Thank
Ms.
you very Kester? Much, Your Honor.
Ah, but I have a question for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, as I understand it, I guess the authorities, the church authorities, became suspicious about him, and they told him he couldn't travel with kids under 17 or 18, but he continued doing it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, those trips were not authorized. So those trips aren't those trips for the purpose of sex, right? He's not allowed to do it. The only reason he's doing it, since he's not authorized, it's not within the scope of his job. The only reason he's doing it is for sex. And those are there are a number of those trips. So.
What you're suggesting is they weren't the particulars of the manner in which he was traveling wasn't authorized by the church.
No, not the manner of it. If he had said to them, look, I want to go and I want to have a retreat in Outer Mongolia, and I want to take this cute little 12-year-old, and the church would say, no, you're not allowed. So then he says, all right, I guess I'm not going to Outer Mongolia. Now, if he goes, if he takes that 12-year-old, he's not traveling on church business. He's been forbidden to do that. That's a pure sex trip, no matter what he does when he goes there, because it's not authorized.
Well, it wasn't my impression, and again, the counsel for the government has much more knowledge of the background of this case, but I don't think it was the church per se paying for these trips in any event. I think that, you know, this wasn't a nonprofit organization that somehow was affiliated with the church.
But you can't have someone using as his cover for these trips, for these sex trips, making up something about how he's authorized to do that.
He didn't set them up, and he didn't pay for them, so that was coming from somewhere else. So there was still authority for his travel. He was doing it on somebody's dime. Now, whose, I'm not sure. And clearly, the people in charge didn't have knowledge that he was continuing to defy their wishes and their directive with respect to the age of the kids he was traveling with.
What about Ms. Porter's point that the cross-examination, to the extent it focused on Dominic's not having told anybody, really put in issue what his psychological state was?
That was in play, Your Honor, particularly given the nature of the defense. The theory of the defense was that he was fabricating all this for financial gain. However, I think that if you're admitting propensity evidence under 413 and 414, that my reading of those statutes is it really goes to the sexual activity itself, whether it happened or not, and not how the witness felt about it, or its after effects, or the psychological effects.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Mr. You were appointed on this case also. We thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client. The next